Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Gwyn Sheltimer, my co-host, Felicity Signal-Reed, and our guest this week, Michael Hanlon. Each week at this time, we visit with a local author. We get an introduction to their work, perhaps a glimpse into their lives. Perhaps we'll ask them what prompts them to write. And we definitely get an opportunity to hear them read from their work. Today, we're very pleased to have Michael join us. Michael Hanlon, the editor who tries to guide the Ulupo Writers Group through its twice-monthly meetings, was a journalist all his working life. During those 50 years, he worked as a reporter, columnist, feature writer, editor, foreign correspondent, and war correspondent. He started in England, where he was born, and after coming to Canada, wrote for the Globe and Mail and the Canadian Magazine, of which he was also the editor, as well as for the Toronto Star. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
50 years, Michael. You must have loved being a journalist.
Well, it's the only thing I ever wanted to do. I mean, I didn't leave school until I was 14, and at 15 I had a job as a copy boy on the Sunday Express, which was a big national Sunday newspaper in England, or in Britain. Then gradually got into a job as a reporter on a local weekly paper in Windsor. And then, after some time in the army, and was editor of a group of weekly papers in Stoke-on-Trent in Staffordshire, came to Canada. And that was 1958.
So what do you find exciting and interesting about journalism?
Well, one of the things was that I always thought there was a way that I could get to go somewhere. I always wanted to be a roving person, go somewhere, meet interesting people perhaps, and write about them. Mm-hmm. The thought of being a sort of a journalist was a fairly glamorous job. One of the things in Britain, you know, you'd hope you had the sort of job where you come into work in the morning and you never know where you'd be the next day.
Yeah. So did you ever think of rewriting some of those stories in book form?
People have suggested it, but frankly, try and dredge it all up and do it again. I know a lot of journalists do it and do it very well, but frankly, I just can't be bothered. Actually, sitting down and typing for another 8 hours a day would just be... I don't deserve it at my time of life.
Oh, okay. Well, what did you write about? It talks about you being an international or foreign correspondent and a war correspondent.
Well, yes, I mean, that's just bits, tiny bits of it. Just about everything. Not a specialist in any particular field, although there were some fields that I spent more time in than others. And a lot of foreign work at the end because I was interested in foreign affairs and, you know, travel and seeing places and not travel writing then, but just going there and covering big stories, which was great. I spent a lot of time doing entertainment. I was entertainment editor of the Globe and Mail. And after that, also for the Canadian Magazine and for the Toronto Star, I did a lot of entertainment writing. I spent a lot of time in Hollywood, go down there sometimes for 2 or 3 weeks on end, just to do stories about movie stars and things like that.
Must have met some exciting people in your
Oh, yes, I suppose, yeah. My favourites were Peter O'Toole, Michael Caine, Julie Andrews, James Stewart and Jack Nicholson and people like that. I mean, it goes way, way back.
Sounds like fun. Days. What were some of your most fulfilling assignments, though?
Well, one of them is the one I'm going to read a piece about shortly, was the Velvet Revolution in Prague, because it was a turning point in history, and it was one of those few occasions when I was there right at the very beginning. I was in Berlin doing the Berlin Wall had just come down, so I was in Berlin at the time, and they said, go to Czechoslovakia, because they're opening up. And I'd never been there before, and I didn't like to tell the foreign editor at the time, well, they've been open for a long time, so it's not really that new, so we went. Also, unfortunately, the Air India crash, but in New Delhi, I spent a lot of time there. And a lot of time in the Middle East. I love the Middle East. I covered a couple of Ethiopian famines. That was good. So all sorts of things like that.
Strange. Quite varied, really.
Yeah. I mean, one of the good things, I'm a big fan of the Tour de France. And I happened to be there when the Canadian cyclist Steve Bauer was wearing the yellow jersey for, I think, 5 days in a row. So I got to go to the Tour de France. That was a big thrill for me.
Yeah.
Anything like that. Things like
real
that.
Real milestones in history and, things like that. Yeah. Wonderful. What about the editing side?
Well, when I came to Canada, I'd been editor of a group of weekly papers in England. And I went there as an editor, as a copy editor, not knowing exactly what I was going to do when I got there. And because of my background, occasionally I would be what they then called cable editor. I would handle a lot of the foreign news, which was interesting for me. And then also I'd handle on the night desk the entertainment news that came in. So when they needed a new entertainment editor, I got that job. Mm-hmm. And I was also a copy editor on the Globe magazine. It had its own weekly magazine in those days. And then I was a daily columnist on the Globe and Mail after that. And I quit in a huff over something that's too long to go into. Unfortunately, I didn't have a job, but fortunately, the Canadian magazine was starting, which was another weekly magazine that went in newspapers all across Canada on weekends. And I went there as a writer, and they sent me out to Vancouver to be Western Canada correspondent. I'd never been there before, so that was kind of fun. And that's when I started to do Hollywood. Then I came back to be assistant editor and became editor. And then a friend of mine that I'd worked with at the Globe and Mail had become managing editor of the Toronto Star, and he wanted me to write a column, so I went and wrote a daily column there.
Well, so you've pretty much done it all in the newspaper world.
Everything. The only sports story I can think I've done is the Tour de France.
Oh, there we go. Well, perhaps you would read one of your favorite articles for us.
Well, this is from the Velvet Revolution in Prague. Well, actually, this is what happened that launched the Velvet Revolution. And I'll start. It explains it itself. I was there covering it, as I say. I went there from Berlin. It's Dateline Prague. And here's the story. And let me just say, this happened, got back to the hotel late at night after this happened. I had to write and couldn't get a phone out because they shut down all the phone lines. So we managed to get it all.
It's almost like a movie, isn't it?
Yeah, in a way. Dateline Prague. Czechoslovak riot police went on a systematic, vicious rampage to break up a peaceful sit-down demonstration here last night. And I was a victim of their clubs as they launched a bloody, unprovoked attack on a good-natured crowd that included elderly women and children. We were part of an estimated 50,000 people who rallied in the capital yesterday, posing the biggest challenge to the hardline authorities in more than 20 years. We were with young students trying to reach Wenceslas Square, where student Jan Palach set himself on fire in 1969. But police trapped us and made sure no one escaped without taking a beating. Even people trying to leave with their hands raised in surrender were forced to run a gauntlet of two lines of baton-wielding police who struck at everyone who went past. At least one of the policemen held a snarling German shepherd that snapped at everyone trying to flee. There may have been more than one dog, but I didn't notice. I was one of those racing past with head bowed, trying unsuccessfully to avoid the blows of the police. I had taken a blow on the head earlier and was one of several hundred crushed against the wall and a row of cars by police who swept forward with riot shields and sticks. Women were screaming and all around people were gasping for air. But I was one of the lucky ones, although I got another blow across the shoulders and a bad one across the back of the thighs as I was forced to run the police gauntlet. Dozens had blood streaming from their heads. When those beaten up at the beginning tried to leave to get treatment, police forced them back into the crowd. About 1,000 people were trapped as police wedged them in from both ends of a city block in the National Theatre and less than half a kilometre from Wenceslas Square. A middle-aged, grey-haired woman in front of me was thrust back violently by a young policeman as she tried to walk to safety before the police attack. And when she tried to hide in a doorway as the advance began, she was hauled out and knocked to the ground. Earlier, as the student demonstrators sat in the roadway, chanting slogans and placing lighting candles in front of the police, she'd said, "It's very nice to see these young people start this. They're so witty and funny." It all began at 4 p.m. as an officially sanctioned demonstration, only the second in Czech history since the Prague Spring was put down by Soviet military might 20 years ago. The students were allowed to march to the National Cemetery, where a young student martyred by the Nazis is buried. Yesterday was the 50th anniversary of the day Adolf Hitler ordered all universities and colleges in Czechoslovakia closed. Before they set out, they heard speeches from student leaders and academics who had been part of the demonstrations 50 years ago against the Nazi oppression. No police were to be seen. The students sang college songs and the national anthem, held a minute's silence for students martyred by the Nazis, and held banners that said, "We want freedom for Christmas, stop beating the streets, and respect academic freedom." One sign directed against Communist Party Secretary Miloš Jakeš, who is considered inarticulate and speaks with a bad accent, read, "We all, you know, want demokracie." And they chanted, "Svoboda, svoboda, freedom, freedom." And Jakeš out, Russian army out, abolish the secret police, dinosaurs resign, we want a new government. The march to the cemetery was peaceful. Four traffic policemen passed on the way, smiled as the students urged them to join in. On shallow hillsides along the route, students held 1,000 candles aloft in the crisp night air as the demonstrators strolled past. And then, after a brief vigil at the grave of Jan Oplatal, the student shot to death by the Nazis 50 years ago, several thousand demonstrators just decided to continue walking beyond the agreed parade route and into the city centre. There were no leaders urging them on. Obviously, they were heading for Wenceslas Square. After about a kilometre, they were stopped by some 300 riot police clutching two-foot truncheons and riot shields. The students sat in the road, chanted, "The world is watching you," and tossed flowers at the police, who threw them back without smiling. "Don't step on the flowers, don't step on the flowers," the students yelled. By now they'd been joined by hundreds of citizens of all ages. After a 45-minute standoff, the students started to leave. Then the police charged after them, running down the street, lashing out with their truncheons at anyone they could reach. I ducked into a doorway with an American reporter and a defiant woman who later said she was 59 years old. Police ordered us out, but we refused to move. The police retreated, and the crowd, perhaps 2,500 strong, continued on its way, giving a cheer as it passed the apartment building that houses Václav Havel, the persecuted and dissident Czech playwright. At the National Theatre, they turned right onto Narodny Street, on the way to Wenceslas Square, and after 800 metres were confronted by about 500 riot police. This time the standoff lasted for more than an hour. The parade was peaceful at all times. Students at the front of the parade went up to police to speak to them, give them flowers. But at no time was there any provocation. The crowds, still joined by hundreds of other Prague citizens, sang the haunting Czech national anthem, "Where is my home?" One arm extended and two fingers held aloft like a victory signal. They held key rings up and rattled the keys in unison in an eerie, tinkling sound. When the police told them to go home, they answered, "Wenceslas Square is our home." And as they sat facing the row of wet police, other policemen were moving in behind them, cutting off their way of escape. At 8:40 p.m., the police began to move forward, striking at everyone in their reach. Edward Lucas, a British reporter who was standing alongside on a sand bin, said he could look over the crowd, was hauled to the ground, knocked unconscious, and dragged away. He has since recovered. On my side of the street, at the head of the crowd, the police were led by a thick-set man in plain clothes who put on gloves and punched and kicked anyone who tried to approach him. The police advanced unrelentingly, swinging their truncheons at anyone in their way. The sidewalk was stained with blood as they ran over anyone who fell to the ground. Another wedge of police drove the crowd together from the other end of the block. In the middle, hundreds of people were crushed together as the police pressed forward. Instead of trying to help people in danger, the police continued to close off any safe way out. What should have been a wide avenue of escape at the end of the street was reduced to a narrow bottleneck by police, who forced people to run between them and to take more punishment. Beyond that, police grabbed people at random and flung them into buses to be taken away to detention. As I limped back to my hotel a kilometre away, two ambulances passed me. They were far too little and far too late.
Well, thank you, Michael. And now we'll take a short break.